Hello, and welcome. This is a podcast presented by the Politics and International Studies Department at the University of Warwick. My name is Tom Whelan, and I'll be hosting today's episode. Today we are joined by Max Warwick, a teaching fellow at the University of Warwick. Max is the course director for the International Politics and East Asia MA course, as well as being the convener for the master's courses East Asian Development Policies, East Asia Development, National and Regional Perspectives, and last, but certainly not least, International Relations of the Asia Pacific, the last of which I can personally attest to being a truly excellent course. Alongside his teaching responsibilities, Max is a coordinator for MA Student Experience and Progression and coordinator of the East Asia Study Group, who regularly host events, research projects, and high-profile speakers at the university. As we will learn more about today, Max's research is primarily about the connection between culture, politics, and international relations. His main focus is on Japan, particularly on connections between media, militarism, and security. His latest publication, Manga and Militarism, Rehabilitating Military Violence in Japan, is, in my opinion, a must-read for anybody interested in Japanese militarism or security. It's a pleasure to have you with us today, Max. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me and reading the article and saying nice things about it as well.
So, should we just get started? I've given a little brief introduction about what your research is, but in your own words, what is your research about and what are the core themes that you explore?
So I guess at its simplest, my research flips a standard premise in the Japan security debate. The standard premise being that culture resists militarism, resists security policy development in Japan, so much so in fact that even if you can see empirical evidence of Japan shifting towards a more remilitarized or normalized position, the pacifist culture that Japan has cancels that out. It means they can't do anything with it because they don't have the societal will to send soldiers to Taiwan, to send soldiers overseas, to send more soldiers to support the United States in a Taiwan contingency. So I flip that by looking at how culture helps, supports, and encourages not only security policy normalization, but also militarism more broadly. And I guess the broader theme of that is looking at the relationship between politics and culture, and specifically in this article, looking at how the imperatives, incentives, and motivations of the media entertainment industry can have implications for politics as well.
Okay, thank you very much. Now, there you touched on a few concepts such as the media, and in your work, especially focusing on Japan, you talk about things like manga and anime, as well as concepts like militarism. For any of our maybe older or less culturally aware listeners, what is manga, what is anime, and what is militarism?
There's like a library full of different definitions of manga,
right,
is as well. So the simple, straightforward one is it's Japanese comics, though it's a little bit different to the more American or French-style comic because they use more cinematographic techniques like zooming in, zooming out, revolving angles.
So there's a distinct art style and artistic direction with it.
Yes, and depending on who you listen to on the Japan side of things, that distinctive art style makes manga very, very easy to consume. I've met people who say they can get through a whole tankobon, which is a compilation of manga episodes, which is how they're typically packaged and resold overseas, in 20 minutes. Because they just flip through the pages and just get the code, that get the data from the different artistic styles. Anime is, that's a bit more straightforward. It's the shortened word of animation.
Fine,
in Japanese. Okay. So that's what it is, it's a cartoon. Well, militarism does what it says on the tin. It is creating an environment, creating a culture that leads to us having a natural, or treating militaries, the existence of militaries, and the response to all political issues with military force as a normal, natural thing. And that wanting to be in the military, wanting to respect the military, is a natural, good, normal thing.
Right. So could it be thought of as a catch-all solution to problems, in terms of the military always has a presence there?
Well, I don't think you'll find anyone sort of pursuing it as that, because it generally is it's a negative term, right?
Yeah.
Militarism, it's sort of associated with an irrational respect, an irrational love for the military, and particularly in the context of Japan, militarism, as far as they're concerned, led them into, not as far as they're concerned, it did lead them into what they call their dark valley of history,
right,
where rather than hearing a statement from the military and analysing it on its own premise, its own basis. It was from the military, therefore it was right.
Right.
I think that is core is what militarism is. Mm-hmm. This is what the military is saying, therefore it is correct, therefore we should do that.
Right, okay. Fantastic. Now, in terms of manga, how does manga shape social change? And is it that manga is shaped by social change, or is it that manga itself acts as a catalyst for social change?
I would need to do a bit more research and see whether or not it acts as a catalyst for social change. Though I think manga, like other forms of popular culture, it's less about the direct impact it has. Though I think we can all think of cultural artifacts that have had a direct impact on policy. The British example being the Mr. Bates and the Post Office, and how that really pushed through something that had been stuck in the courts for more than a decade.
Yeah.
But it's more about building up a consensus, about realizing that consensus is being built around you and shaping policy that way. In the article, I used the example of Said in particular. There wasn't necessarily a direct connection between the travel writing books that orientalized the Middle East and Asia more broadly and colonial policy. Travel writers weren't going out there thinking, right, we are going to sort of build up and justify colonialism. Mm-hmm. They were going out to write travel books and sell travel books, which is probably why they put in an extra exoticization when they're presenting the Orient and the Middle East. But that exotic presentation of the Middle East, of Asia, did contribute to colonial policies because it gave them the justification, well, they need us to go and govern for them because look at, just read about them, hear about them, they're childish, they're immature, they cannot possibly govern by themselves, they need us to step in. It helped to justify that white man's burden.
Right.
So manga, on occasion, it does pop up in the Diet in Japan's parliament, and even manga that feature the self-defense forces have popped up in the Diet. Normally held by a member of the socialist or opposition party to sort of yell about how awful it is that this sort of thing is now in the public realm. You do have to go back to the 90s for that kind of thing. It's a lot more accepted these days. But it plays more this role in building up that consensus that creates a field, clears space for policymakers rather than having that direct impact. Though I'm sure there are a few manga that have this sort of take on that this sort of totemic power in the same way that a manga like, I'm not sure if you're familiar with this one potentially, but the story of Barefoot Gen, Hadeshi no Gen, or the anime by the Studio Ghibli films, not by Hayao Miyazaki, but by his partner, Grave of the Fireflies.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. Which is a pretty upsetting bit of watching, but has a very strong, irresistible anti-war message to it.
Yeah, I think it's shown in every school, at least in the UK, from what I've seen. There's very much an anti-war, anti-World War II message, definitely. So, from what you're saying there, it seems that this is much more subliminal than overt generally. It's rare that this is a deliberate mechanism to bring about political change, and it's more that that is coincidental, or do you think that there is some element of deliberate pushing a narrative?
But I think there's a mixture. It's difficult to go too much into the incentives of the consumers, because I'm sure there's a broad range of people who buy a manga which is about the self-defense forces fighting sea monsters because there's a pretty girl on the front cover, with those who, I'm really into the self-defense forces, I'm fed up of this anti-militarist, anti-Japan nonsense, and I want to read about the military being good guys. On the creative side of things, it's a mixture. So the manga industry, effectively its creative authority has been hollowed out by its professionalization. In the 1950s, what we understand as modern manga was very much a countercultural movement. It was produced by amateur artists, by self-sustaining cottage industry, very small-sized publishers, largely based in Osaka. And the mainstream manga industry that has a history that goes back to the mid to late 19th century was mostly aimed at children. But these mainstream publishers, specifically the first one that noticed this was Kodansha, still one of the biggest publishers in Japan, they noticed the popularity and success of this counterculture. This counterculture that typically involved very, very adult themes, very anti-authority themes, very sort of not child-friendly themes, shall we say. Mm. And they saw an opportunity there. So they hired, well, invited some of those manga artists to produce manga for them. Aimed at adults, aimed at children, aimed at teenagers. But that sort of, the aesthetic I was talking about earlier, that's where it came from that counterculture.
Mm-hmm.
And the artists, the amateur artists, many of them took this on because, you know, why wouldn't you? A bit more stability. Some did resist it, but the ones who resisted it typically did die out.
Right.
But by being brought into the professional industry, they were locked into a often weekly publication cycle. And producing typically 20 to 40 pages of manga in 1 week takes a lot of work. So these artists became dependent on the editors and the publishers to supply them assistance.
Mm.
Often themselves aspiring manga artists who would be in, they don't call them stables, but effectively they work as stables or studios, that's a better word, studios.
Yes.
And hoping that one day the editor will happen to glance at their side project, their portfolio, and say, oh, that's interesting, I'll make a manga out of that too, right. And they can get their own studio. But what that meant was that apart from a very select few artists who had the ability to push back and say, no, I'm not doing that,
mm-hmm.
they had to do what the editors said, or they were very susceptible to the influence of editors.
Mm.
A book I referenced quite a lot in the article by Sharon Kinsella, there's an interview with a manga editor. And on the surface, it's quite entertaining, but when you look at the deeper implications, it's very upsetting. Saying, to get my artists to do what I want, I use tactics of secondhand car salesmen.
Right.
I go to them and I push the narrative again and again and again, saying, do you want a new car? And they'll say no. So I'll go away. But then I'll come back the next day. So do you want a new car? And they'll say no. And I just keep going again and again and again. And eventually they give up. It's such a great trip. And then the bit at the end, of course, I don't have to do that for the younger artists because I can just cut their pay.
Right.
So artists are generally producing what editors want them to produce, and what they want them to produce is stuff that they identify in the market.
Mm.
So if the market shows an appeal for pretty young girls with guns, you're making those.
Right.
If it shows appeal for soldiers, you're making that.
Mm-hmm.
In the 70s and 80s, there was appeal for that anti-establishment, and there were lots of manga anti-establishment. Maybe showing my age here now, but the film Akira, that is very anti-militarist, very, not necessarily anti-war, but it's just very, has a very, very dim view of authority more broadly. Politicians are corrupt, generals are the ones running the scenes and sort of cutting corners to get what they want. And that was produced by a big mainstream publisher because there was a market for it.
Mm.
That market has since gone away. That's the more interesting story that my research more broadly is trying to engage with, how that market has shifted. Now, going right back to what you were saying in terms of the creatives, there are some creatives who just follow the instructions.
Mm-hmm.
But even within those creatives, there are a few of the more right-wing persuasion who, for reasons either because they were in the forces themselves or they have sort of grown up in a different environment, they do not like how security is traditionally spoken about in Japan, and they want to change that.
Right. So there is a proactive element as well, even if it is largely stemming from editors, people who...
Publishers,
that's the word.
So yes. I would say there is... Again, I hesitate to say proactive element, because they have their own motivation.
Mm.
So if you're X-Forces, you want to sort of write a manga where the self-defense forces go into a different realm and fight cat people.
Right.
Because you want people to think nice things about your friends and your old job. If you are, for instance, someone like Kawaguchi Kaiji, who's been more on the record about, I think Japanese people need to wake up a little bit.
Right.
About the security threats that face them. Then you have a different thing going into it. The relationship between it is the editors... And the market is creating the space for these creatives to come out.
Mm-hmm.
And because they're coming out and they're doubling down, it's sort of reinforcing and it's really pushing the zeitgeist in that direction.
Yeah, I was going to say, it seems that it is largely driven by market forces and what society wants to buy.
Mm.
It doesn't seem that there's much pressure from politicians and government for it to go in this direction.
Mm.
Or do you think that there is some there?
I think it depends which politician you speak to.
Mm.
There are some who very much wanted to go in that direction, who think that Japan is turned to a heiwa boke or peace idiot country, and they're all spoiled and they don't know sort of how hard it is to maintain peace and they need to wake up. And there are also a lot of other politicians who think that's awful, that, you know, the whole point of Japan is that it's founded on a pacifist constitution,
mm-hmm.
you know, one that was forced down their throats by the American government at the time, and they resisted it at the time, but whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a lot more in the middle who are more concerned with tax policy.
Right, okay. This is outside their domain.
Yes.
No problem.
And actually, that's the same for the larger populace in Japan as well, actually, I would say, in terms of the change you're seeing in society coming out from the manga, that right now, the biggest sort of topic of debate in the parliament is tax policy.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is how they're going to pay for the security program they set out in 2022, doubling the defense budget.
Right.
Though the Americans are now pushing them to triple it, but we'll see how that goes.
Mm-hmm.
But the controversy is not around, what, you're going to get more guns, you're going to let the self-defense forces help the Americans, this is awful. That sort of passed about much notice, about much pushback. What people are more worried about is, well, I don't want to pay for it with my taxes.
Right.
That's the point of concern.
Mm.
I would say that from the government side of things, there are those who would like to see it go in that way, but for reasons due to their priorities we talked about earlier, and also in the case of the Ministry of Defence and the self-defence forces themselves, genuine trauma of not wanting to get yelled at by the media, a relationship in the Cold War defined, but as, you know, typically very combative, where the self-defense forces were accused of everything, where they couldn't do right, really.
Right.
Either, you know, it's ridiculous, we shouldn't have a self-defense forces at all. I mean, there was a speech in the Diet in the 1970s where essentially a Soviet fighter jet defected.
Right.
Lieutenant Bodorenko, I think. He defected, or he was trying to defect, and he was bringing his nice new MiG with him, so this is good.
Yeah.
And he was trying to contact the Air Self-Defense Force to say, I want to land my plane, guide me in, because I want to defect. But they couldn't locate him. And there was, you know, they have all their modern equipment, but they couldn't find him. So in the end, Bodorenko had to sort of find the airfield himself and land himself.
Right.
And this was controversial in the parliament, because one, it showed that the defense forces didn't know what they were doing, and at the same time, they shouldn't exist. So in the same speech, right, okay. They shouldn't exist, they're terrible, and also, why aren't they defending us properly?
Right.
So that is what they think, a lot of people still think of when it comes to media. So their stance is, we don't want to be seen, we don't want to be engaged with, and there's a bigger emphasis on when there are collaborations with the Ministry of Defence, with the self-defence forces, particularly when it comes to cinema, less so with manga,
mm-hmm.
that the self-defense forces are presented in a way that hides their military-ness.
Although I do feel like the UK is shifting more in that direction, particularly in some of their more recent advertisements and recruitment campaigns.
Mm.
There is this element of, it's an adventure, it's fun. There isn't really much mention of guns there.
I mean, I've showed some Royal Navy adverts to some students recently to talk about feminism, and it involved someone on a gun shooting down incoming missiles.
Right.
So I think there's a difference that in the sort of the UK context, there's a real emphasis on professionalisation and putting out the message, this is good for you, this is a stepping stone to your future career. Whereas in the Japan context, like a recent advert, the tagline was, Watashiwajiikan nan desu kedo, which means, oh, actually, I'm a member of the self-defense forces. The whole idea being you see a woman out in a nice, lovely dress taking pictures of a lamb, and, oh my God, she's actually in the self-defense force. I didn't expect that. Yes, we have this sort of lovely, nice people in the self-defense force because we're a lovely, nice institution. It's really that kind of shifting where we're not military, we're not elite, we're just normal people. So
who
please stop shouting at us.
Who happen to be protecting you, but we're mostly just very nice people.
Yes, but again, for that, we happen to be protecting you, isn't up at the front.
Right, yeah.
And it's often at the back sometimes as well. Mm-hmm. It's sort of pivoted to this, you know, it's a fun job, it's a special job, it's a normal job. Or what was quite common for a while is, we're just bureaucrats.
Mm-hmm.
Just think of us as bureaucrats.
Yeah.
So even as society has sort of shifted more, actually, it's outpaced the Ministry of Defence, they're still sort of dragging their feet quite a bit and are still very, very cautious of any media engagement.
Which is surprising. You'd imagine that they'd be more, especially as society shifts, they'd be more willing to jump on this wave. But I guess because of the reasons you've explained.
There's potentially voices within sort of saying you should do this, but again, also soldiers who are busy doing soldiery type things.
That they are busy people.
I think there is still a caution And there's also this broader cultural trend, I suppose you could say, about wanting to be too essentialist, but it does kind of check out that things change very slowly in Japan when it comes to the governmental bureaucratic level. There is caution about media engagement, which isn't limited to Japan either. Other militaries are equally cautious when it comes to, or at least suspicious of, certain types of media engagement. Whether the self-defense forces will eventually start shifting more towards this narrative, I think that, I mean, you can already see them starting to do that with their recruitment campaigns, moving away from the fun, silly stuff to posters like Japan Pride, and you see a woman in a uniform with a tank behind her, not a woman in a dress uniform doing the peace sign smiling and kicking her leg up doing a little dance thing, which was a different recruitment campaign.
Interesting. So from that, we're kind of establishing that Japan isn't unique in using the media and military, that they often coincide. But do you think Japanese media is unique in how effective or ineffective it is in influencing society, politics, and the military?
I don't think there's anything particularly special about the Japanese media. I think it is different to a military entertainment complex like the one in the United States.
Yeah.
Because from the government, Ministry of Defense side, they're not proactive about it at all. They wait to be invited in. And even when they're invited in, they are very, very cautious. They are less cautious when it comes to manga. But again, that's largely because the policy around how do we cooperate with publishers, with producers of anime, with video game producers, it's not really been legislated and they don't really know what to do. And it's done on a very ad hoc basis and has, I've been told, does tend to change depending on who is the Vice Minister of Defense.
Right.
Whether or not they have a positive view of the media, a negative view of the media, whether they're outgoing, ingoing, you know, all these different things. So I wouldn't overemphasize the connection between the media and the government because it's not quite there. It's starting to form, but it's not locked in the way that you'd see with the Americans.
Yes.
But manga, specifically, when it comes to its other, in comparison to its other popular mediums, is different and does have something of an edge, which I talk about in the article. Daniel and Musgrave write this article called Synthetic Experience, making a case for why popular culture should be studied as a medium in international relations based on cognitive science and psychology. But they say that distinction between what's sometimes referred to as first order and second order representation, the first order being newspapers, policy speeches, documentaries, you know, things are coming more direct from source, and the second order, the representations of the representations, the TV shows, the cartoons, popular culture, more generally, that distinction gets lost in a cognitive process which only focuses on, I think they say, 10% of all information, and the other 90% is automatically passed through this cognitive process without being scrutinized.
Right.
And the point about that dual process model is when we engage scrutiny, at what point we sort of pick up the material and say, no, I'm looking at this properly, I'm not just accepting what's on the page. And the typical thing that does that is our familiarity with the material and also how much we trust the material. And they talk about, they use the psychology term transportation, others use a cultural studies term of estrangement, that the material, even when it is clearly silly, clearly frivolous, if it creates a world which you trust, you will be transported, you will be estranged, and you're not going to be scrutinizing it.
Right.
So it slips in to your subconscious more easily. Manga sits between, in some cases, first order and second order representations. It sits between them because popular culture more broadly, it's common for real world stuff to pop up in popular culture. Manga, thanks to this genre called information manga, it is expected for very serious material, very serious subject matter to be presented even in a frivolous way. Alexander, I think it's pronounced, it's spelled B-U-K-H, and I recently heard him say boof. Other people call it book, but I don't know. But Alexander Boof or Book, did an experiment with his students as a limited sample size, but it's still interesting, where he asked them to read two manga with revisionist stories, Introduction to Tina and Hate the Korean Wave.
Right.
And after he asked them to, after they read the manga, he asked them questions about China, about South Korea, and about Japan's wartime history more broadly. And he broadly found that to greater and lesser extents, all the students' views had changed to become more aligned with the views expressed in the manga, despite at the front of it all them saying, these manga cannot be taken seriously because they are manga.
Right.
So that gives manga as a cultural artifact a particular potential to help sort of shift the conversation, shift the zeitgeist one way or the other way.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's things slipping. Even if you don't realise it, it's all going on. And so because of these kind of phenomenon, you know, you've mentioned a few today, do you think that more broadly in international relations, art, literature, film, are they analysed enough? Or do you think they're kind of overlooked? Because when I think about my studies especially, kind of usually focus on realism, liberalism, which don't tend to have focus on these elements at all.
I'm trying to sort of give a just answer because my instinct is to say no. But no, I think, well, you know, you've identified it there. The traditional focus is on more the first order representations because there is a privileging of those as being more true than other representations. And I'm not a post-structuralist, but they make a very good point that if everything we have around us is sort of constructed and made up by us talking and enacting these thoughts and beliefs which we conjure, then in real terms there isn't that much distinction between what's produced in a cartoon and what a politician is saying. It's all sort of part of this creative mess. And understandably, a lot of IR scholars are sort of give pause to that because that sounds like a very extreme thing to say. But you look at things like that, the cognitive dual process model, at broader work done in the field of literature studies. Mikhail Bakhtin, in particular, talks about the role of the carnival and how it acted as this space for creating or enabling new ideas to be explored and being a potential source of resistance or even revolution. And these things, art, popular culture, whether it is part of reinforcing a cultural hegemony or breaking that cultural hegemony, they are worthy of analysis and helpful for understanding the broader context, understanding the consensus upon which policymakers rely or to which policymakers appeal with their speeches, with their acts. And I have other examples I can talk about, but I don't want to tax too much of your time.
No. You have been excellent. And I think we are now drawing to a close. So if you have anything that you would like to signpost for further reading for anybody interested, anything of your own that you would like to promote alongside the article we've mentioned, anything at all, now is your time.
Okay, well, thank you. I guess promotion-wise, the article. if you are sort of interested in follow-up reading around Japan in particular, and I made notes ahead of time on this, so around talking about the changes in Japanese society or how Japanese society developed this culture of anti-militarism, as it's often referred to, Akiko Hashimoto's The Long Defeat and Yoshikuni Igarashi's Bodies of Memory talks about different cultural artifacts, textbooks, literature, film, and photography, and how they've helped to, and actually in the case of Igarashi, a wrestler, how they've helped to create this sort of anti-militarist but then slightly militarized society. In terms of understanding the role manga plays more broadly, I'd recommend Nissen Otamazgin's edited volume called Rewriting History in Manga, from which I got the book, the Boof experiment.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you very much for joining us today. This has been the Pays Politics podcast. Thank you for listening.